This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Why hated candidates win. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
How about this for counterintuitive? If your favorite presidential contender has a high unlikability rating, he or she has greater odds of winning the White House.
If you dread going to work each day because of the manager, we'll explore how to tell if the problem is you or the manager.
There's been a so-called baby lull since the recession. Find out the serious impacts it could have on the economy in the future.
And the new online series about baseball's greatest rivalries, featuring former Yankees great Bernie Williams, who recalls his interaction with Red Sox fans.
They would like leave it all on the field, and when it was time to be civil again, you know, and in the city, he was more like, you know, I hate the Yankees, and, you know, obviously let me know how they feel about their team, but they respected the individuals.
Bernie Williams, four-time World Series champ, is here in about 20 minutes. Well, you may shake your head at the unfavorability ratings of the two leading presidential nominees, especially Republican Donald Trump, who polls say is liked even less than Democrat Hillary Clinton. But here's something to consider. It's not uncommon for the most undesirable candidate to win. Here's Ash Skow, reporter at the Washington Examiner. Ash, what about these two?
So they're both historically disliked. But what I found, if you look at the comparisons between all the other elections going back to 1980, the person who had the highest strongly unfavorables usually won. There was only two cases where it didn't happen, and that was 1992 between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and then in 2000 with Al Gore and George W. Bush.
Wow. All right, so is it easy to determine what we owe that to? Is it name recognition?
Well, that's usually where the strong unfavorables come from, is that people know a candidate. So usually they like them more just because they know them, and they dislike them more because they know them. And with Trump and Clinton, there's really no people who really don't know who they are. And you can do a little bit more along with polarization of politics. But if you also look at another chart that 538 had that showed the net favorable rating, which is the strong favorables minus the unfavorables. And again, Clinton and Trump, way, way into the negatives, even when you do that. And most other candidates, back going back to 1980, were right around zero when the net is taken into account.
Wow. I can't imagine that these numbers will change much over the course of the next 6 months.
No, I think they could probably only get worse for Trump once, you know, the mainstream media starts an onslaught on him, although they've kind of tried during the primary. But once he goes after Clinton, that might hurt her as well because he has such a commanding presence of the media. But he might do so much between now and general, we don't know what he's going to do. He might continue the way he was in the primary, or he might try to be more presidential. So that could make people like Clinton more if he goes full Trump, or like her less if he really hits on her the way that actually is going to make a difference.
Yeah. Wow. We're speaking with Ash Skow, commentary writer at the Washington Examiner. She's got an interesting look at the presidential candidates in a piece called "The Most Hated Candidate Usually Wins." I get the sense, too, with the polarization of these two candidates, that voters have already committed, right? I'm not sure you're going to say anything at this point that's going to convince a Clinton supporter to vote for Trump or vice versa. Does that mean it comes down to voter enthusiasm?
I think it does come down to voter enthusiasm, and if there are any undecideds at this point, the independents, where do they go? But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people, these charts show that people don't like either candidate, so there might be a lot of people just sitting this race out who are, I don't want to vote for Trump, but could I really vote for a Democrat and vice versa?
Yeah. I suggested a few days ago, although this chart doesn't necessarily show it, that if your unfavorability ratings combined as the leading candidates are over 100, you must exit the race. And then you you get to name somebody else, though, in your stead.
Well, that would be nice, but could you imagine Clinton or Trump actually following that and being like, you know what, people don't like me, let me give it up, hand it over to someone else. Right. I just don't see either of them giving up that way.
Right, not with those two egos. But it's just amazing, though, looking at this chart that you have, how both of them seem to be just in uncharted waters. They are past everyone else since 1984 in terms of unlikability.
Right. The next most disliked candidate was George W. Bush in 2004, and he still won that election in a landslide. Mm. And here we have 2016, Democrats were set to nominate the most disliked candidate in history, and then Republicans, rather than nominating someone who could really capitalize on that, they decided to just one-up the Democrats and nominate the absolute most hated candidate by, 20 points? As far back as this chart goes, which is just way to go, Republicans.
I still can't understand, though, how these candidates have both won or are expected to win with those unfavorability ratings. Like, somebody likes them.
Yeah, I mean, Trump has a strong unfavorable of 53. Well, then that 47 must have been the ones out voting for him, in every race and more and more. And as for Clinton, she was just blessed by the electoral gods of having weak opponents, or Bernie Sanders, who really could only capitalize on the youth vote, and the youth vote is so small.
Thanks, Ash. Ash Skow, reporter at the Washington Examiner. 13 minutes now after the hour. Here's to the innovators and job creators. Dell is proud to support small businesses everywhere with reliable, award-winning technology powered by Intel Core processors, created to give your business 4 times faster performance and cut downtime by 50%. During Small Business Month, enjoy 35% off select business PCs, plus always get free shipping and advice from Dell's dedicated experts. Visit Dell.com/radio to discover how we can help you do your best work. Intel inside, powerful solution outside. If you're looking to grow or relocate your business, there are 3 numbers you should know: 10, 2000, and 6. 10 stands for Michigan's ranking as a top 10 pro-business state. 2000 is the number of unnecessary regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6 stands for Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climate. All those numbers add up to the one state that is all that and more, Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Question for you, where are all the babies? The U.S. is experiencing what some call a baby lull following the recession, and ramifications can be expected. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Women in the U.S. aren't having as many babies as they used to, and that's expected to have a long-lasting effect on the economy. With more on this trend is Janet Adamy at the Wall Street Journal. Janet, let's start with some numbers. What's the current birth rate compared to years past?
Sure. Well, in the U.S., fertility for the last 20, 25 years, it kind of hovered right around, on average, most women had 2 children over the course of their lifetime. But in 2007, when the recession started, we saw that number really plummet and dropped to a low of a little less than 1.8. It's starting to climb back from there, but the concern is that a lot of women who put off having babies simply waited too long or kind of got used to life without them, and they're not going to have them.
What are some of the other reasons women aren't having as many babies, and will this change?
There are a lot of social and economic forces, and the main thing is that among the millennials, there's uncertainty about the economy. People feel like their jobs aren't as stable, and that has probably the biggest effect on people having children. You also see things like less attachment to religion, more women graduating from college, which makes the cost of pulling back to raise children greater. We've seen fewer immigrants who tend to have more children coming into the U.S., especially from Mexico. And so there are a bunch of forces at play here. Then there's also among the millennials, they're just waiting longer to get married. And so when you wait longer to get married, you're going to wait longer to have children, too.
I was going to say there are a lot of studies out recently that teens are having fewer babies and older women are having more babies. How does that change things?
It's generally considered good news that the birth rate for teenagers has been dropping pretty dramatically. And I think most people agree that that's a good thing. And the options available to older women these days to have children, whether it's with the help of fertility treatments or whatnot, also a very good thing. Where the concern comes from is that if you can't hit a replacement rate for the population, these lower fertility numbers, they weigh on everyone from home builders to stores like Babies R Us and even hospitals that have maternity wards.
How does it affect home builders?
The sort of cycle of people maturing and, you know, hitting those milestones in their life. So instead of getting married and buying the first home, some of those millennials are choosing to live in apartments. That means fewer single-family homes being built, or at least less demand for single-family homes. It puts a bit of a damper on the demand side. And then, of course, with the retailers, you don't have as many people buying cribs. You don't have as many people needing strollers. I was really struck by what I heard from the hospitals, too, which is that they're seeing a slightly older population come in, and they're reworking their maternity wards as a result. I talked to one that was moving a neonatal unit closer to their closer to where babies are actually being born, and one reason was it's just good medicine, but also because as more older women have babies, there, you know, you have slightly higher rate of complications, and so there's a greater need for the neonatal unit to be there.
So I'd imagine a lot of people are really parsing these numbers.
Yeah, and I think there's a hope that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom here. I mean, the good thing is that the worst of the dip in childbearing finished in 2013 and that the rate has been slowly creeping up. And I talked to some demographers who think that probably if the economy does improve, that, you know, more quickly than expected, if immigration does pick up, that there could be more of a baby boomlet. But the concern is that this is the rate is going to stay below the average of two women per child for potentially 5, if not 10 years.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with The Wall Street Journal's Janet Adamy. And our finance update has been brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Come as a guest, leave as a friend at Lexington Inns and Hotels. We'll treat you to exceptional service and a hometown touch. Visit LexingtonHotels.com. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Sounds of former Yankee baseball player Bernie Williams there. Sheraton Hotels and Resorts has partnered with Major League Baseball for an original content series about baseball's most heated rivalries. It's called Rival Town Rundowns. And one of the guys featured is former Yankee great Bernie Williams, who won 4 World Series as a center fielder with the Yanks. Bernie, you must have stories about Red Sox fans during visits to Boston.
You know, I was actually made it my point to walk down Boston Street after games, especially the day games, and to have a little bit of an opportunity to interact with some of the fans.
Is that right?
Down after games, yeah, man. They would, they would like leave it all on the field, and when it was time to be civil again, you know, and in the city. It was more like, you know, I hate the Yankees, and, you know, obviously let me know how they feel about their team. But they respected the individuals, you know. Okay. You know, they obviously realized that they were human beings as well. And the team didn't really have a great reputation for being, you know, like rowdy and boastful. So they hated the team, but they didn't really hate the individuals. So I was able to always have a good time when I went down to Boston.
Well, you know, I grew up as a Mets fan and, you know, wished horrible things on the Yankees. And then when guys like you and Posada and Jeter, when those guys came through the system, it was like, how do you not like those guys? So that made me mad because then I got a soft spot for the Yankees, so it made it worse.
Yeah, man, it was kind of hard to root against us, man. It was that we try to play the game the right way,
right,
and concentrate on doing the right things, you know, playing hard, you know, not really talk too much in the media, and just let our playing do the talking. And that was a good combination, you know, to be lovable.
All right, so give us some Boston inside stuff here. Where would you visit, for example?
Yeah, man, you just, you know, get a time to, you know, get up, walk around. There's a great architecture in the city. Obviously, Boston Commons Park, you know, it's a little bit smaller than Central Park, but it's still a great place to walk around, see some nature. There's actually a bodega that has a shoe store hidden behind, and that's quite, I found that to be quite interesting. The Sail Loft Cafe, have a great seafood, Bill's Bar, a great place to have a drink after the game or before or during. You go to, obviously, Fenway Park, you know, me being into music, you know, going to Berklee School of Music to check some things out there. And obviously, Newbury Comics, you know, and the music store had a great collection of CDs and music that I was able to enjoy a great deal. So a lot of good places to see and a lot of great things to do.
I remember you. I was in the locker room a handful of times during my old reporting days. Did you still play the guitar a little bit? I know you kept it near the locker at all times.
Absolutely. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm taking it to the next level and pursuing a degree at the Manhattan School of Music. Hopefully, by the end of this semester, I'll be graduating with a bachelor's degree in jazz performance. So I'm taking my music to the next level.
Check you out. Wow, we're speaking with Bernie Williams, the former Yankee and four-time World Series champ. He's launched an original content series about baseball rivalries called Rival Town Rundowns in partnership with Sheraton Hotels and Resorts. You still pick up a bat, by the way, because based on the Yankee run production right now, they could use you.
Yes, only in softball games, and I need to have a great deal of an advantage, you know, as far as running the bases. I actually hiring like extra running people to run for me these days. But it's always enjoyable to have an opportunity to grab a bat and try to swing as hard as you can in case you hit it. That's one part that will never leave me.
Good. You see, we played like a men's softball league. That's not even fair. Is that right?
No, it's more like charity games.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I actually do a concert in Richfield, Connecticut, at the Playhouse, and we kind of tie it up to the community, and we have a day of softball in which we play our team, my Bernie Williams All-Stars. We play the fire department and the police department in Richfield, Connecticut, and we have a great time. I don't think we have won a game yet in the 3 or 4 years that we've played. But it's always a great thing to have the fans there, you know, and to root for us. Then we top it up with a concert at night. So it's a win-win situation for everybody involved.
Former Yankee Bernie Williams. It's called Rival Town Rundowns, this project he's involved with, and you can find it on MLB.com. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office, and it's so easy. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. They even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. And setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter the code Deal. Is the lesson given to today's young athletes something along the lines of winning is all that matters? Given the constant suspension of players, professional, for example, for use of performance-enhancing drugs, you might think that that's the message. We're joined now by Joan Bauer, author of a new book called Soar, which explores how to discuss this issue with kids. Joan, how do you do it?
How do you discuss it? I think you just come out boldly and you say, let's talk about cheating. Let's talk about it. One of the things that I've been able to do over the course of my career writing for young people is I visit a lot of schools, and kids love to be asked, what do you think about this? What do you think about this big issue? And so really get some of their thoughts about it and tell them what you think about cheating. And then I think it's very, very important to then turn the tables and start talk about consequences. Look at what happens, you know, if somebody starts using steroids. They don't get into the they don't continue on. They have an 80-game suspension. There's no, you can't go into the Baseball Hall of Fame and find anybody who has a shadow by their name. There are mighty, mighty consequences. And I think when kids begin to see that and they hear you talking about it, that is one of the ways to begin. But I also think we have to be very careful to not put unrealistic expectations on our young athletes. Focus on what their best is, not what the scoreboard says. And I think beginning to incorporate those things into our parenting, our teaching, our coaching can really help young people.
All right, so when it comes to sports, is it best that a child not even have a sports hero, or is it best that it's okay to have one, but kind of manage your expectations realistically?
Wow, that's a fabulous question. I think it's always good to have a hero. But I also think we know that we have to always go into it with some humility, and we all in different ways have feet of clay. And I do think, though, that when these problems happen, it's always good to talk about the people who really have had very, very good reputations and to lift them up, to lift up the ones who are doing it right, to really show kids that it can be done. You can really excel. You can be a knockout player on the field, and you can play the game right.
Mm. We're speaking with Joan Bauer, author of a book called Soar, and we're looking about the issue of cheating in sports and how to present that to your kids. If there, say, are rumors in town or their favorite athlete has been caught up in a scandal of some kind. How about the role of parents? Go into that a little bit more, because there's a lot of pressure, I think, that parents put on kids these days, right? Got to win that scholarship.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we have, yeah, we do. And, you know, when you sit and you watch your kid play and you see a bad call, there's this instinct in all of us to want to shout and say that wasn't fair. But I think the greatest thing that parents can do right now in terms of sports is to teach their kids this great old word, grit, to teach them the importance of resiliency. And we need to remember that, you know, we are all hardwired for struggle. I mean, just think about how you learn to walk. You fall down, you get back up. You fall down, you get back up. You keep trying harder. So to encourage bouncing back after mistakes and failures, and to let them know. I love this. I read this recently. Winston Churchill said, failure isn't fatal.
Thanks, Joan. Joan Bauer. The book is called Soar. It's 21 minutes before the hour on this weekend. So do you dread going to work because you work for a miserable boss? Think about it this way. Any chance the source of misery is actually you? Tech analyst Rob Enderle says sometimes it's your boss, sometimes it's you. Either way, it's important to figure out what's what, then decide if things are fixable. Rob, what do we do about this manager?
Well, the first thing is figure out why. The only way you're going to be able to address a problem is if you understand why they hate you. And it can be any one of a number of things. It could very well be that your hire happened without their approval or authority. In other words, it's a senior manager pushed you in, or a policy pushed you in. It could be that your personalities conflict. Often, however, it's because you're not listening to what the manager's asking you to do. You're doing one thing, the manager's asking you to do another. One of the real common problems is, and you see this particularly with younger employees, where they go in and, you know, they're working really hard and they're helping everybody else out, but they're not getting the work done that they were actually employed to do, and they don't seem to grasp why that's a problem. But if you can figure out why the manager hates you, then you can determine whether or not it's something that's fixable or not. I mean, if the manager hates you because they're a bigot, or they hate you because they're sexist, or they hate you because of some fundamental reason you can't change, then just get out. I mean, there's not much you're going to do to fix that particular problem. On the other hand, if they're pissed off at you because you're not social, if you're not listening, those are things that you can absolutely fix and address.
All right, so I guess explain the different scenarios. I mean, if it's fixable, it's likely what?
Well, so if it's fixable, then it's likely something you need to do with your own behavior. It's something that you're doing that's pissing the manager off. Maybe you're showing up late and leaving early. Maybe you're falling asleep on the job. Maybe you just have a manager that doesn't like to express themselves that well. You get these passive-aggressive managers that are just incredibly difficult to figure out. But at the end of the day, it's your behavior that's ticking them off. And if you can address that behavior, you're going to move ahead. Now, one of the quick ways to do it is talk to some of the other people that have worked for that manager, either currently or previously, and try to figure out where they've worked and how they've fixed the problem.
And think about that. Yeah, very good. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. His piece is about how to deal with a manager who hates you. What'd you go through?
Oh, geez. Well, you know, I've had a number that were really bad. So I think the worst was a manager that was asking me to falsify records, and I'm an ex-auditor, and there's just no way in hell I'm going to do that. And so he and I bumped heads, and I finally figured the only way to do it is to formally escalate and complain out, and the company, thank God, transferred me to another manager. But trust me, when you do that, you carry a stigma. You blow out a manager. A lot of their managers are going to look at you a little bit sideways, figuring you might do it to them. And that manager went out of his way to suggest that I was just gaming the system and cheating to get around the rules that he thought were legitimate rules. Shortly after I left, because it became very clear to me that I needed to change companies, that he was let go as well. So the end result, though, is, as they say, where it's always worked best is you get to know the manager, understand if you can be social with them, get to know your coworkers, understand what's working and what's not working, and try to do the stuff that's working.
Thanks, Rob. It's tech analyst Rob Enderle. 14 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend.
A great business needs a stunning website. And with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery, grow your contact list, and get all your social media in one place, just the way you want. Your customers are going to love it. So, what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy and free.
The Cronut, a croissant-donut hybrid created by the French chef Dominique Ansel, has become a phenomenon since it made its debut 3 years ago this week. Consumers still line up for it daily in New York City, even after the shop closed temporarily because of a mouse infestation. In fact, it's so popular that Wall Street Journal reporter Sophia Hollander says for some New Yorkers, the Cronut has played a pivotal role in their romantic history. Sophia set this up.
Turns out that the Cronut, which is a pastry that was created by a French chef in New York City, has actually become the centerpiece of multiple love stories in New York City, which is kind of funny because the way that you get a Cronut is you wake up at the crack of dawn, you wait in line for several hours in the cold, and then you eat gigantic amounts of calories. But it actually has turned out to be the linchpin in multiple relationships and even weddings.
Get out of here. How? Why?
You know, I think it actually, although it's a little counterintuitive, it is a great date spot because it's a bonding experience. You're in the trenches. You're united by a shared goal. And as some of the couples said, you literally have nothing to do except talk to each other. Strangely, it can really bond people together. And, one guy who I interviewed in the story said he'd been trying to, get this girl to go out with him forever. And she kept saying no, but she really wanted a Cronut, so she agreed to wait on the line with him. And now they're getting married.
That's funny. So who's the one guy you talked to or profiled here who actually embellishes this with engagement rings and Cronut boxes and stuff?
Yeah, so, a few people have hidden engagement rings in Cronuts or Cronut boxes. You have to be really careful with that so that the person doesn't eat it, obviously. But one of them, I actually waited online and watched the proposal in person, and the first thing that she said when he kneeled down in the shop was, "You're crazy," because she was not happy about getting out of bed, at 5:30 in the morning, and she was very confused and slightly suspicious when he insisted that she put on full makeup, for this proposal. But then she burst into tears and everyone clapped and it was really beautiful.
That's unbelievable. We're speaking with Sophia Hollander, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers food, and her piece is entitled Love, Patience, and Pastry, Dating in the Age of the Cronut. Explain what else you learned here or came across.
I think that one thing that, was just surprising to me is that this week is the 3-year anniversary of the Cronut, and there are still lines literally every single morning that start before 7 a.m. So just the endurance of this pastry, which is a different flavor every month, was surprising to me. It was surprising that, people have made Cronuts into their save-the-date cards. It's, you know, united couples from Montreal to Los Angeles to, you know, to Brooklyn. And, you know, I knew that people liked it and I knew that it was delicious, but I did not expect that it would have created so many relationships. Actually, one woman who I interviewed said to me, you know, now that we're talking about it, I can't believe I'm getting married because I waited online. you know, so I think even for them, it's a little surprising.
Yeah. How widespread, I guess, is the cronut interest? Is this just like a, I don't know, New York City, Los Angeles thing or what?
No, you know, it's become a little bit of a global phenomenon. Dominique Ansel, who's the chef, recently opened a place in Tokyo, which also now has lines every morning. Wow. And he's in the stages of opening another shop in London later this summer. So, you know, it's taking over everywhere.
So how many calories does one of those things have, or do I not want to know?
So many. You don't want to know. It's you know, it's a croissant donut hybrid, but then that's not all because it's filled with a jam and a ganache, and then it's topped with icing and sugar. So, and it's big.
Mm. I have not had one, although I suppose it should be on my list. Wall Street Journal reporter Sophia Hollander in New York. It is 6 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Well, just how popular is Facebook right now? Here are some stats compiled by MarketWatch. Number one, on an average day, more than 1 billion people are active on Facebook. That's roughly 1/7 of the world's population. Number two, we look at Facebook more frequently than we do the Bible. Just 37% of Americans say they read the Bible either weekly or daily, but 56% say they read their Facebook feed at least weekly. Number three, more than 1 in 4 Americans use Facebook while they're sitting, you know, in the bathroom. Number four, we spend as much time on Facebook as we do on personal grooming. That's about 40 minutes a day, you know, hair, makeup, all that stuff. Number five, more than 1 in 10 users always check Facebook if they wake up in the middle of the night. And number six, even grandma is in on it. More than half of adults, 56%, over the age of 65 that use the internet are now on Facebook. That's from data released last year from the Pew Research Center. That number, by the way, is up from 45% in 2013. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.